Sagar and Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment.
And this is a very unpopular point of view because in general, you're either pro-institution or you're burn it all down. And I'm neither. My feeling is reinflict heterodoxy within our institutions and you'll save everything.
All right, guys, it's been a totally crazy week. As some of you might know, went on Joe Rogan for 3.5 hours, then did an hour and a half interview with Joe Rogan after that, which you can find on the Breaking Points podcast and YouTube channel. And then Marshall and I interviewed Dr. Eric Weinstein. So basically, the hustle never stops. It's been an awesome week down here in Austin, Texas, where some of you guys even recognized us, which was awesome. And we had a really good conversation with Eric in a great follow-up to the one that we had before.
Yeah, and you can't see this because this is audio, but I rushed straight from the airport back to Brooklyn to take this recording. Sagar's busy, so we're wearing t-shirts. Eric will scold us during the episode, so if that doesn't make any sense, he is not quite happy that we were not wearing our suits, ties, button-up shirts for this. So hope you all will forgive this. It's been a crazy week. Normally, we'd shout out Q&A, Substack, all that stuff, but it's been crazy. Y'all just want to jump in. We'll be back next week with regularly scheduled programming, but welcome. And of course, this is also available on YouTube, so check out the channel as well, too, if you enjoy watching us talk with Eric. It's really simple. Huge thank you, Lincoln Network, for supporting our work. Let's dive into the episode.
Eric Weinstein, welcome back to The Realignment. Really appreciate you joining us.
Hey, it's great to be back, and it's great to see that there's other stuff happening with you guys. So congratulations to Sagar. I know you guys are all friends and that you're not cheating on Marshall with Crystal.
Well, I mean, actually, we've always been friends. It's just that we were restricted for some very bizarre reason over at The Hill. But we have a lot that we want to talk to you about. The last time that you joined us, it was right after January 6th. It was one of our biggest, in my opinion, one of our most important episodes, and it drove a very emotional response. So we're sitting here together. It's been about 5 months since then. How are you thinking about this current moment? January 6th was a moment of turmoil. It was a time where I think your message of love and needing to come together was probably more needed than ever. But here we are. It's strange. Some people call it boring. In my opinion, there's tectonic shifts happening. What are your general thoughts about where we are at right now as a society?
We're in a superposition of just about everything. We are being we are bored. We are exhausted. We are being menaced by UFOs. And somehow these things don't make sense if you put them all together. So I think that what you have to understand is that somehow the developed post-industrialized world is in some sort of a crisis that no one can even define. And so it's a little bit strange. You imagine that during the Black Plague, people could say, hey, this is a plague. We don't know what's causing the plague, but we know that we're in a plague. My guess is that our phones have changed us so that nothing excites us. I keep making the same horrible points that I think that we've become inured to pornography even, that, you know, nothing, violence shocks us in one context, not in another. Sexuality shocks us in one context, not in another. We have UFOs, it's like the craziest story in the world, so far as I can tell. And I think what really you have to say is imagine that you found this really mysterious canyon in southern Utah, and you clap and you expect to hear an echo, and then you hear a bird, and then you clap again and there's nothing, and then you clap again and it says, there's no one here, go away, this is not a CIA facility. And you're thinking, this is not behaving like a normal canyon because I expect echoes and reification. And I think what's going on is really fascinating in that nobody really trusts the mainstream, but if the heterodox aren't reified by the mainstream, then we don't think that the heterodoxy matters because we know that our institutions still care about the mainstream. And so in a weird way, you have these super exciting conversations that in some sense almost feel like they amount to nothing. And you, plural, and I are part of this alternative archipelago. We came from the mainstream. We are in the diaspora, sort of the mainstream diaspora, and it's making monkeys out of all of us. I think it makes us all, the mainstream looks insane. The heterodox look irrelevant, slightly unhinged. The information is inconsistent. Apparently I have a 78-year-old president who's going toe-to-toe with Putin. I'm not always positive whether he's exactly sure what he's doing. Everything remains thermonuclear. However, the gas pumps still work, sort of. There's some supply chain issues. There are no adults anywhere. And I really kind of think you guys are part of this movement towards adulthood. And I kind of thought you'd throw on a jacket, both of you, but we'll get there.
I'm traveling, Eric. I'm sorry. I'm in Austin. I'm already adopting.
We have to be very precise here. I literally just got off the plane from Newark and rushed here to be on time for this recording. So our
Marshall,
stand-up undressed is a sign of respect.
No, sir. I'm worried you don't have enough money to be wearing the outfit that you're wearing. I remember when Sergey Brink turned up to an event in shorts when everyone else was in the suit and tie. You at least have books behind you. I'm not sure what's going on with Sagar. What's on your mind, gentlemen?
Well, here's what's on my mind. I want to ask you, I love your framing of no one is getting excited by anything. What excites you? Because you've been spending time in these spaces for a long time. I was thinking about this in the context of Sagar going on Rogan this week. I'm like, how does Joe get excited about talking about anything after thousands of episodes? What are you excited about right now?
Look, I just came from an amazing meeting with the High Vibe Guitar Company, who's making player guitars like people have player pianos. Super excited by Tim Henson of Polyphia. So that's some sort of arty thing. I think I more or less came out with a theory of everything, which is a very strange thing to say. And I sort of would like to not say it in those terms, but I think the most interesting thing is that it doesn't engender any kind of response that you would imagine. Even really the sort of hardcore scientific perspective from within the academy. The UFO story nothing lands. And so in a certain sense, I think what you have to do is you just have to assume that your eyes are correct, your brain is correct, and that the outside world has gone mad. Somehow it's mediated by our phones. And the fact that all of our institutions are consistent with a hijacking. I'm not saying that they have been hijacked. In fact, my theory of embedded growth obligations is that everything is not functioning because of a common ideology, which is that the U.S. had a secret vulnerability. So the exhaust port on the U.S. Death Star was that low growth had never really been experienced and that we don't have a plan for low growth.
Huh.
So everything from the 70s on, really.
Yeah, probably even a little bit earlier than that. And then, I also think that and this is a very unpopular point of view, because in general, you're either pro-institution or you're burn it all down. And I'm neither. My feeling is reinflict heterodoxy within our institutions and you'll save everything. Fail to reinflict heterodoxy. If you don't have a Noam Chomsky at MIT, MIT can't function.
So let's tease that out, actually, because I think that's very important. I think I get accused a lot of like, oh, you're just very critical, like anarchist, like all you want to do is tear down institutions.
Sorry, nobody's calling you an anarchist.
Well, I've heard it before. I mean, like, why are you doing, criticizing Fauci or something like
for
that?
God's for God's sakes. I mean, because Fauci is ridiculous. I mean,
well, yeah, thank you.
No, but I'm saying, look, meanwhile, in adult space,
yes,
that's not what's happening. It's
that's
just
fair.
In fake adult space, I know what you're talking about.
That's a fair point. And I think, though, this is what I want to underscore for a lot of people, which is that you said you neither want to tear down institutions or defend them in their current form. Right. What is the end state? So I've said before, it's not that I'm anti-elite. It's that I think we need a better elite. I think I'm not sure if that's necessarily something you would agree with.
No, we need an elite.
Okay, go ahead. So expand on that. What do you mean?
We need an elite. If my child needs surgery, I'm going to go find an elite surgeon. If my child is kidnapped, I'm going to find elite commandos. Why am I not entitled to elite scientists, elite medical people, elite politicians, elite strategists, elite media? No. We're dying from a lack of elite, and the reason that we all are anti-elitist is because the elite aren't. I don't know who these people are. Mm-hmm. I can see them in their chairs. You know, it's sort of like, you know, if a crazy person sits down on a throne, okay, so now you've got a crazy person sitting on a throne. Well, there are various important chairs that people are supposed to sit in, you know, chaired professorships historically. And by getting us all to hate the concept of an elite, it certainly serves the interests of people that I really wish were more frustrated in life.
I have a question to what you said earlier, your point about you need Noam Chomsky, the famously leftist linguistics professor in MIT's. Why, and this isn't my view, but this is something that's going to come to mind of a lot of audience members. Why do we need MIT's? We have Noam Chomsky's. Noam Chomsky, if he were young, could have a huge YouTube channel, a huge podcast. Why do you think we need an MIT in the first place?
I don't know. I was at MIT. There were a lot of really important people and really important things that got done there. And so why do you need institutions? I mean, that's a very millennial Gen Z perspective. And
it's because, one, though, that I think a lot of the audience is going to ask, right?
Well, of course, yeah. Because you've never seen an institution function. If you've never seen an institution, I mean, look, I only saw functional institutions when I was a young person. I certainly don't see them now. And so, of course, we're embittered. But, you know, I keep hearing things like, you know, every organization can't function and nobody can keep a seat. Well, how did the Manhattan Project happen? How did we invade the beaches of Normandy? Come on. This idea that you're going to have an app for invading, you know, there's an app for that. No, there isn't an app. You need an institution. You need an army. You need scientists. You need laboratories. You need brick and mortar. Human beings can't just decamp to the internet. We're not all going to be able to upload in silicon or reboot from tardigrades. This is ridiculous. Human society requires institutions. And right now, because of a concept that I don't think people have really discussed. Jennifer Fried, a psychologist at the University of Oregon, has an amazing theory called institutional betrayal. The idea being that when an institution is charged with caring for us and it betrays us, we experience a type of trauma that we do not see elsewhere. Betrayal by those charged with caring for those who cannot care for themselves directly, like a surgeon in an operating room, causes something terrible to happen. And I've only slightly improved it, which is the concept of universal institutional betrayal. No one has a concept of that. And that's the whole idea behind the embedded growth obligations. I don't want to have to explain why TJ Maxx and Yale are having the same problems. In general, what's going on is that we have this concept of an embedded growth obligation. Everything has to grow or it goes crazy because it becomes a Ponzi scheme. And so we were used to this. We didn't have a plan B. And now we've got universal institutional betrayal because every institution has to be headed by somebody who's comfortable with the idea that they're going to be running a Ponzi scheme if they can't make growth happen. There are very few institutions that are continuing to grow endogenously and organically at a real level.
Quick so thing then, well, sorry, yeah. I just want to get a direct, because this actually ties back to our episode of Eric Torenberg, where he was talking about higher education. Yale was and is an institution, by its very definition, does not grow. There are a limited number of seats. That's how you maintain credentialism. That's how you maintain the almost nightclub aspect of elite higher education. Can you expand your idea of growth to other aspects of American society beyond just TJ Maxx? Because I get that one there. I know the shareholders have expectations there, but let's expand it a little bit.
Well, I mean, the typical one is, I mean, the university system really did grow. And the key issue would be that the elite institutions, the Harvards, the Princetons, unfortunately, Yale sort of stumbled because they didn't understand the importance of the STEM stuff and they invested in the wrong place. But let's take Princeton, MIT, Berkeley, let's say. They would typically train people who would then go down into the rest of the system. So the top departments would populate the second and third tier departments. And then the second and third tier departments would need to get work done. And so when you need assistance that you can't afford to hire on the open market, what you do is you promise them a future. And as long as the institute, you know, because we went from educating sub 10% of the population to approximately half of the population post-secondary level, there was a long period of expansion. So I'm going to disagree slightly that the system did expand. And, you know, we had a free labor thing. So when the bill came due, you were supposed to hire people because your students were never students. They were your workforce. They were trained professionals and they were getting even more training, but mostly what they were doing was sacrificing their youth for the promise, and I'm, you know, wait for it, of academic freedom. The big benefit of being in the university system was is that you had a middle class to upper middle class lifestyle with the intellectual freedom of a billionaire. And when you throw away the intellectual freedom of a billionaire, you stop being able to select for the people who you need in your research enterprise. And because nobody seems to have intellectual freedom almost except for us, we've got a real problem.
So here's the question there, but this is the trade-off, right? Which is that, yes, we may have intellectual freedom, but we don't necessarily maintain those formerly mainstream credentials. And so the difficulty, I was actually recently, I just did a crossover episode with Joe Rogan, which will be available, I guess when this airs, it'll be fully available on the Breaking Points YouTube channel. And I asked him this question. I was like, to me, I think the craziest thing in the world is that millions of people listen to this podcast, and yet the institutional awareness of it at the highest echelons of American power seem non-existent to zero, as in some of these people are vaguely aware that Rogan exists, or they just pretend that he doesn't exist at all.
So B
is the thing, but then there's just a silence like around it, around maybe us. Like my show gets a lot more viewers than CNN, but I'm not stupid. CNN has way more of an impact on the day-to-day policy process. What's the trade-off there?
Because your audience is people. Their audience is institutions.
So how do we change that? What's the road to changing that?
We've got to take our first institution back. And I kind of hoped it was going to be the, you know, University of Chicago. And then it sort of ended up as Trader Joe's, who refused to capitulate, which is very confusing. I think it's important that we go back to the University of Chicago. And one of the really crazy questions is, why can't we have one institution that flips the bird to all of the people, you know, who are drinking out of juice boxes in the elite chairs? I don't understand why no billionaire is at all interested in endowing anything that is insulated from the market in order to keep sense-making alive. And the key thing is that you have to appreciate that the business model of the gated institutional narrative, or GIN as I've called it, is in part to talk their book by negging everything that occurs outside of it. So in other words, you were a smart guy when you were inside the GIN, but now you're an anarchist.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Crazy. What's he talking about? Right.
But this is the issue is I have to stand up for you, because otherwise you sound like you're special pleading. You sound like, oh, I don't have the influence of the CNN, or then you're bragging. Well, I have the greater reach. This is why, Marshall, you know, forgive me for one second, but this is why Rising was so important to me, because you guys had stumbled on a formula that nobody really understood. Dave Rubin had actually stumbled on the same formula. The optics, in some sense, of the mainstream with the soul of a pirate. That's the formula that matters. The ability to speak with reasonable diction to, this is why I'm complaining about the jackets. And you guys, you'll notice I almost always, even in Austin, my friends, I appear with a jacket. And the idea being that somehow the brain has a question. Why am I not seeing the ante that we expect of an adult? The well-tied scarf, the decent professional lighting, you know, all of that nonsense speaks to the amygdala or some lower portion of the brain that it is listening to something that is adult in nature. And for whatever reason, we have this complete division between a narrative that makes no sense but is listened to by institutions, and then this diversifying element, which is heterodox people who can finish complete sentences, appear to be reasonably well-informed, possess credentials, who are absolutely not listened to or are universally denigrated as part of a business model of keeping the guild closed. That's where we are.
Right.
Well, I want to speak to the business model because I don't want to be too laudatory of the heterodox space, because I think this is an 80-20 situation where, actually, I did the math wrong, but I think the top 20% of people who are operating in the heterodox space are doing really innovative, really important work. The people who are going independent, like Crystal and Sagar, people who are writing really remarkable work, you know, say
Ben Greenwald, Barry Weiss, Lex Friedman, you guys.
Matt Iglesias, after he left Vox, the work he's doing at Substack is infinitely better because he has a business model that's focused on quality rather than clicks, all that stuff. That being said, there's a bunch of people who are also grifting, because the problem with the business model of heterodoxy
right now— Don't use the word grifting.
Why not?
Because grifting is a technical term. It's a reserved term. It is.
So what would your terminology be for it?
Well, we have to understand, grifting is those employed at legacy institutions complaining about people being able to earn a living outside of legacy institutions. That's the new technical definition. The old archaic one was that you were, you know, scamming. Mm-hmm. So yes, there are some scammers and there's some negativity in our space, but more or less, if you do something with integrity that's halfway smart, that reminds people that they're not insane, you can generate a huge following. I've done everything wrong with my podcasting, my feeds. There's nothing I've done right. I haven't taken it at all seriously. And you can't swing a cat without, you know, walking around and finding somebody who says thank you. You know, I was just at Cantor's Delicatessen in Los Angeles, and I think the busboy came up to me and he said, "I really appreciate the fact that I can listen to interesting conversations." We're drowning in smart people who can't figure out why all of the formerly smart people seem to be perfectly insane.
Right. So this is what you said about the canyon, which I found really interesting, which is that it's very difficult to interpret the signs. And I agree with you on the UFO thing. I think it's literally one of the most important stories in the world. And all I'm asking is somebody take it somewhat seriously. Like somebody, I used to be a Pentagon correspondent. I'm like, maybe just one person. That's like all it takes.
We're waiting for Jon Stewart to freak out in front of Stephen Colbert. And this is what bothers me. That thing that just made the rounds. Mm-hmm. Sorry to interrupt you, but
No, please.
I always have the feeling that we're three ethnic guys and that we can talk over each other.
You're right. Yeah. No, go ahead. Go ahead.
We're waiting. That was like some weird scripted moment. You know, Stephen Colbert is asking about, you know, something in science. And John says, "Well, science caused this problem." Stephen Colbert is like, "Wait a minute."
He's like, what? Yeah.
Oh, my God. This is we have to walk back from a world in which people like me who couldn't stand Trump said, "You are not allowed to take the Wuhan Institute of Virology off of the decision tree." The Lancet debunked it. Mm-hmm. I really feel like we're just in a sandbox with badly behaved toddlers who can't think straight. And then we need Jon Stewart to tell us it's okay to have that thought. It's okay now, by the way, the Time Magazine article said, you know, Trump was right. There was a conspiracy against him. We fortified the election. You did what? You know, so now you're admitting that you fortified the election, that Trump didn't necessarily clear a square of protesters for a photo. The mainstream is just thoroughly cranky. And we are slightly cranky in part because we can't get decent information. But if there was reasonable reporting, you know, I don't even think I mentioned UFOs once before April of 2020. I've never had an interest in it. Never. Mm-hmm. You know, talk to me about your aunt's ghost or the Loch Ness monster, you know, Sasquatch and the Yeti getting it on. I couldn't care less. But then, you know, suddenly it's serious business. And where we are is nobody can figure out why we can't inflict heterodoxy anywhere. This Jon Stewart thing is an embarrassment. I mean, I used to love Jon Stewart, and then I found myself saying, "Yes, you're saying what I'm thinking. Wait a minute, I'm the grown up, not you." Mm.
Well, it's not, you know, Jon Stewart's fault, right? It's everybody else's.
Jon Stewart's fault.
Why is that? Because well, he, it's he? Not like he was Well, where was he doesn't it? Have a show, right?
Yeah, yeah, so I was risking my Twitter feed. Right. I was risking my program. I haven't, you know, put out an episode in, I don't know, half a year more. Mm-hmm. More than half. I'm terrified that basically I've got people at Facebook, Twitter, and Google who are scientifically incompetent, who are running trust and safety, saying, you know, nobody's responsible. My brother had a video, a PhD in biology, talking to MDs, maybe one of the developers of the mRNA vaccine technology, other physicians, and it takes down because you violated our policy on misinformation. And my feeling is your mother at home? Is there an adult I can speak? Who runs science for trust and safety? I can't keep yelling and screaming. It's just like, there's a concept called an adult. You need to find one. And I also, isn't it strange that all of our billionaires are completely uninterested in building new institutions or saying anything that's really meaningful, and then we wait for a John Stewart moment to tell us that it's safe to get back in the water?
I mean, Eric, we know a few billionaires. You know 10x the number of billionaires that we do. So what's going on?
People are sawing off the limb that they're sitting on, which hasn't broken yet. And somehow we're waiting for a really close call. We're waiting for, you know, a suitcase nuke to go off in Tulsa, Oklahoma, or something to say, hey, maybe we really need to think about that. I remember as a child being taken into the cockpit of a 747, I believe, and being introduced to the pilot. And I remember thinking as a little kid, why is anyone letting a little kid into the cockpit of a 747 with passengers on board? Like, we're just... It was a nutty thing to do. And that wasn't obviously nutty until 2001. But then it became rather obvious. And it only cost us two buildings and a portion of the Pentagon.
You just spoke to something. I really love the sighing metaphor, but it also brings up a problem, which is that every 10 years, at least within Sagar in my lifetime, you've had a moment that you feel like is probably that close call. So whether it's the 2008 financial crisis, that was just when we were becoming politically cognizant. So I remember, wow, we're going to have to, you know, that was the original Great Reset. There were a couple of books and articles that were talking around that. That was, we had to question our capitalistic system.
Careful with the Great Reset.
Yeah, I know, but that's, I mean, yeah. I was like,
careful.
Listen, everyone, listen, we're good to go on.
No one wants to build back better than me, baby, but.
yeah, that's the title of the episode. But at the same time, wasn't the entire COVID experience, which we are still very much in, especially if you're in a country like India, isn't that the close call? But it doesn't seem like you believe, it doesn't seem to think that that's what we're doing. What's your reflection on this?
Look, I'm old. I remember when I felt things directly. I remember when things meant something, and we're having a crisis of feeling and meaning. And I don't think people really understand it, but this phone thing that we carry around is clearly reprogramming us. So that we can't feel, we are insensitive. You know, I have this, I've told the story a few other places, but I have this recurring nightmare of a father taking a picture of his child on a bridge and saying, back up, back up. And the kid backs up right to the rail and says, back up. And the kid goes right over the side. And the father rushes to the rail and sees the child, you know, falling in the canyon and said, oh my God, I'm getting all of this. Remember to wave. You know, and it's just this idea of, I did an entire episode of my show about seeking arrangement in Sugar Baby University, the way in which by jacking up tuition higher than medical inflation, higher than regular inflation, making it non-dischargeable in bankruptcy in 2005, I said, you baby boomers as a generation are selling many of your daughters into borderline prostitution. How do you feel about this? There is no reaction. So when prostitution and pornography become absolutely acceptable career options because nobody can figure out how to make money in a regular labor market, when people aren't forming families because they believe in antinatalism, there is no waking up. People are going to go to their deaths and they're going to say, hey, that's fine, that's great. And this idea of meaning you have to effectively hold the line somewhere. And I think as an atheist, let me just sing the praises of religion. Individual atheists can be very moral, can have very meaningful lives, but we don't know if atheism scales. Mm-hmm. I go back to our founding documents, and I've only recently can't come to appreciate the following. The word self-evident and creator do a lot of working. These truths are not going to be discussed into infinite regress. It's like, time to eat your broccoli. Why, Mom? Why do you think? Because it's self-evident that you will be eating your broccoli. Well, what if I don't agree with that? Well, the creator has said that it is, you must eat your broccoli. If you're endowed by your creator with inalienable rights, it's a way of setting a limit. And I think of this as a little bit like the stitch at the bottom of a sweater. It has a different character than the rest of the sweater sometimes because it's there to keep the sweater from unraveling. When you allow an infinite regress into infinite relativism and you know, everything has to be perfectly just, it's a little bit like a computer that has no recursion limit. And you say, hey, what's 1/3? And then you wait and there's smoke coming out of the computer and it shuts down and it fries the circuit because it tried to compute 0.333 repeating with infinite precision. We got to cut this stuff off. We have to restore meaning. And when you're going to say, well, why do we have to do that? Well, this is a truth we hold to be self-evident. And the creator said, buzz off. It's really important that society continue. We're not having an antinatalist conversation. You're an antinatalist? Congratulations. You don't get a seat at the table. You're part of the suicide bombing community. You don't get a seat at the table. You're a solipsist? Great. There's no seat at the table. Or are you saying that diversity and inclusion doesn't extend to these groups? No, I'm saying more than that. It is essential to exclude certain people from the conversation because you can't have a functioning society if you allow self-extinguishing strategies to be included.
So how do you square that with your position on censorship, Eric? This is something that we talk about all the time. Because I, by the way, I 100% agree with you. The problem that I see is that inconsistent standards make it so that a lot of people are just becoming absolutists whenever it comes to this, which is that we just can't trust these people. So we should just make it so that it's absolutely unacceptable. At the same time, nobody wants to live in like a totally unmoderated society. Like you said, like people who are suicide bombers, like, no, sorry. Like you probably shouldn't be on Twitter, right? So how do we square that as people who are also targeted for some of our beliefs?
Well, where do I begin? I mean, the first thing is that you need culture. The idea of doing everything through law and rules is ridiculous. And as I think I've said to you gentlemen before, the genius of American society is that you have every right to burn the flag that you have no desire to burn. And so how do you get people to culturally realize that they shouldn't burn a flag by permitting them to do so? That's a big loss because there'll always be some lunatic who wants to burn the flag. So the first thing you have to recognize is that you can't afford to lose culture unless you want to have to actually directly prescribe things in terms of law. The second thing is a concept that unfortunately we don't have called regulated expression, which I'm borrowing from genetics. If you think about the pajama experiment and the operon, you don't make some protein or some machine molecularly at the same rate all the time. It's environmentally dependent. In war, we interpret free speech as meaning something different than it means during peacetime. And we sort of quietly do this so that people don't have it rubbed in their face, that free speech is something that can be let out and brought back in. And this is what we do. At some level, you use the magic of a certain amount of nonsense and you put people in black robes and put them on the Supreme Court and immunize them and all these sorts of things to determine, well, can we afford the same amount of free speech the day before we invade the beaches of Normandy as we can, you know, during the middle of the Woodstock Festival? And we need to recognize that we can't afford to do the same things at all times. Now, then you're going to say, well, there are contradictions. You're being hypocritical. It's like, welcome to real life and the dialectic all on the same day, you know, and what you do have is a hypocrisy budget. I'm hypocritical. I don't always tell the truth. Are you guys completely free of hypocrisy and are you always truthful?
Yes. No.
Yes. We're always truthful on the Realignment Podcast and affiliated Breaking Points properties.
Marshall Kozloff for president.
Yeah, good. Good for you.
I never trust anybody who's who says I don't lie. It's like,
yeah, well, of course people do.
You right. did theirs.
Yeah.
Well, here's a question then, because if I were to try to put together a theme for what we've discussed so far, it's this frustration we all have with Orthodox thought, with the mainstream of institutions. But like you said at the start, we come from those spaces, but Sagar and my parents have PhDs, right? You have literally. A PhD. Wait, we're not merely outsiders claiming that there's no value to these systems. So we're frustrated. We're building media. We're starting these conversations. The funniest thing that happens, and you understand this, Eric, is we get a lot of people get mad and we book people from the New York Times for the podcast. They don't understand that, hey, that makes us legitimate. That doesn't mean we have a boring conversation. No, it does. Total pushback on this. It completely does.
Let's have it out. This will be fun.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Marshall.
Yeah, no, the difference, let me add
an addendum. We're not booking them because we want to appear legitimate, but we are booking them in order to have our discussion with somebody who is in that space, which inherently does legitimize part of the discussion. So it's not like we're booking them because we're not interested necessarily, but like there is an interest, but we also understand like, oh, well, this has an added benefit of actually making our conversation maybe slightly more acceptable in the mainstream, which may lead to a John Storb. Please.
You're not looking for legitimacy. You're looking for institutional reification, which is what I'm looking for.
Yeah, right.
That's not legitimacy. Those institutions are not currently legitimate. Nobody thinks, wow, the New York Times, that's the source of truth. Nobody thinks, wow, Harvard said so. The institutions agree to pretend that. And we know that effectively, that's the cockpit. Our institutional narrative is the cockpit of society, and no one is getting into the cockpit who isn't part of this agreement. I mean, if you started to do the sort of stuff that you do on your programs inside there, you'd lose your job instantly.
Yes.
Right? So the whole issue is we can't have anything lodge inside of Harvard, the Democratic Party, the Washington Post, that gives away the legitimacy that the institutions claim for themselves. What I'm trying to say is they don't have logical legitimacy. They don't have scientific legitimacy, as per Anthony Fauci. What they have is a guaranteed client, which is other institutions. And so what you guys are talking about, you have the legitimacy. By the way, they sneak off and they listen to the realignment and they listen to Breaking Points and they listen to the portal and they listen to the Joe Rogan Experience and Sam Harris and all that stuff. And they frequently, I'm sure you guys get it, you know, I can't talk about your podcast at work. I'm only with, I have a secret club that meets, and you're just like, okay, we are engaged in some, I mean, you know, I'm sort of bored of my own points, but this is professional wrestling. And the idea is everyone knows professional wrestling is scripted. And your brain agrees to pretend that it's real, even though you know that it's scripted, which is what a smark is. A smart is a smart mark. You're being conned and you're in on the con. Right? You know, it's like when somebody tells you, hey, I colored my hair, you know, and I'm wearing a pair of heels to make myself look taller, and I've put rouge in my cheeks to give myself a healthy complexion. And they can tell you all that. And some part of your brain agrees to believe it, even though you know that it's not true. Mm-hmm. And so in a weird way, we are agreeing that as long as CNN can keep its optics looking professional and adult, the fact that there are children sitting in those chairs drinking out of juice boxes is not something that has to be addressed.
Let me put what I'm saying in a slightly better frame. Earlier, you implied that Crystal and Sagar had sacrificed a lot by going independent in terms of legitimacy. Wrong word. Let's just ditch that word for a second. Mm-hmm. In terms of what they were able to do with the Rising platform. But as you were earlier discussing with atheism, Rising didn't scale. I appeared on the panel.
Rising didn't scale.
Rising, so on several different levels, Rising didn't scale. So A, because of the fact that you literally couldn't, if Rising had a contract where Sagar could talk about the realignment, Crystal could talk about Crystal, Kyle, and Friends, you could build a bigger universe that scales. But it was a self-contained feature, exclusively featured on YouTube. So at the end of the day, yes, Sagar and Crystal looked great every week. I think I looked pretty good on Zoom on the panels. That being said, it didn't matter. So I'm just curious what you think the actual sacrifice was. I think once they got to 1 million subscribers, I don't see where anything. And Sagar, I'd love to just come in, because I'd love to hear. That's just how I think about it.
What do you think, Eric?
Look, nothing has worked so far. And I just want to be very clear with you. So if you ask me, Eric, what works, I can give you my conjectures about what we should do. But there is no billionaire on earth who's knocking down my door saying, you've got the ball. How do we make how do we try something? There's no person calling up saying, you know, the Washington Post needs a fresh look. Why don't you become a columnist and we'll give you academic freedom? There's no one at Twitter who says, you know, boy, you have called many things right when we thought that we had the wrong interpretation. We thought these were right-wing talking points. And you, who have, you know, come from a left-of-center family, a left-of-center perspective, have gotten these things right. We need to give you academic freedom because it's too dangerous. Right now, everyone who is in the process of, well, I call this the age of extraction. There's a point at which you have a business that was previously successful that starts to sputter and you're trying to save the business. And then there's some other point where you say, you know, we're not saving the business, but I could probably sell that picture frame on eBay and turn a profit. And I wonder if I replace the mahogany desks here with some cheap stuff from IKEA, whether I couldn't, and you know, you're just in this process of liquidating everything. So right now, the Democratic Party and the Republican Party have merged into what I call the looting party. Mm-hmm. And the looting party is busy. And so they don't need this to make sense. They just need us to spend time discussing this in the way that we're doing while they steal the rest of the silver. And you know, that's where we are, is that we're just infinitely saying, well, how do we get in and why aren't we legitimate and why doesn't this scale? It's like, no, we're witnessing a robbery. And that robbery is the liquidation of the assets of a country that's supposed to be handed over generation to generation. Marshall, as you know, in our Jewish tradition, L'dor v'dor, from generation to generation. Well, something weird happened with the silence and the boomers. They couldn't make the American dream work at a renewable level. So they said, okay, we're the terminal American dreamers. And I, you know, that this is what I'm fighting, because it's too late for my generation. It's really important to me that the millennials and Gen Z have a shot at something. And, you know, as I'm fond of saying it, the millennials aren't my children, but I love them more than their parents do, it would appear.
So, Eric, one of the things that you said that I think resonated the most last time you were on is when you were talking about why people, not necessarily why people should sit out of politics, but why the time of those who are needed have not yet been called. Go ahead, Marshall, because remember the direct quote.
Yeah, it was break, like we need break glass leaders. I think that was it.
Break and glass, so, in case of emergency people.
Right. Yeah. And so are you more optimistic today than you were? I think it was like January 8th or whenever you were talking at the development of the break class, leadership class. And if you're a young person today who listens to this podcast, and we have a lot of people who do, many people, they consider themselves political. I call it small p political, as in they care about politics, they care about the world, but they hate politics. They hate capital P politics. They hate CNN and Fox and MSNBC. It's critical. They hate all three. They hate all politicians. They hate everyone. And
they'll hate you too when you succeed.
I'm sure they will. And I'm sorry, guys. You know, I hope I never fail you. And if I do...
You will fail them, and you should tell them right now, I will fail you, because there's no other way to do this thing. And for God's sakes, what you need to do most is to ignore the perma haters, because I got to a certain level where I comment on this sometimes. If you look at my Instagram feed, I used to do all these walk and talks.
I remember that. Yeah.
Uniform positivity. Mm-hmm. And then we cross some line and suddenly something says, okay, time for hate. And it was nothing specific. So in large measure, when anything starts to become threatening, somebody turns on a hate spigot. Now, you know, with respect to a question, I would put you guys in office over almost anyone, even if you're not qualified. You know, Sagar, I don't know that you know anything about physics or nuclear weapons, but I take you at the Department of Energy, you know, and Marshall,
he gets energy. What do
you
get?
You get State Department. You get some.
I give you state. I mean, you know, at some point you have to actually learn on the job in these very dangerous positions. And the idea of Joe Biden telling some guy in his 20s, I'm a caretaker president. Just thinking, yeah, you were a 29-year-old senator. We didn't need caretakers back then. Just get off the stage. But nobody understands this. This is fundamentally the issue of Chamberlain resigning. And I think I've recommended
you did.
To you both.
You told us a story last time. Yeah,
it's time for these people to resign, but they don't understand that.
Well, quick thing, Eric, because I think that's a fascinating idea of the caretaker. Actually, there's a strong case to be made that you did need a caretaker in the 1970s. What's the story that we're telling here? The story that we're telling here, and you said yourself, is that the baby boomers failed. Joe Biden was a part of that baby boom generation that rose up as a part of Watergate. But that's an early start.
It's really in the 80s that the baby boomers look. If you look at the average age of Congress, you know, Joe Biden got an early start, right? Mm-hmm. But one thing I'd like to do is I'd like to start sourcing more people who volunteered to put themselves in harm's way in our military and put them in positions of power. It doesn't mean that they're smarter. It just means that they probably believed in something. If you're going to walk next to an IED, for example, to serve your country, my guess is that profit is not your top issue. We need more people who care about a permanent place in the pantheon. I also think that statues are relatively important in paintings. And people say, well, that's really quaint. It's like, well, you know what? All of those quaint societies bequeathed a renewable society so that you can sit there and say, that's quaint. Mm-hmm. Can you say the same about your ideas? It's like, oh, well, all that's passé and it's over and we're all in the cloud. It's like, okay, let's see whether or not, I mean, I'll be very curious how that goes. And I only wish I'd be here 100 years from now to hear about a project where there are no pictures, no paintings, no statues, no means of commemorating people who make huge risks for the public good. And I think in part, we're soured on it. We want to find out that, Marshall, you are doing this just for profit. And Sagar, there's nothing else other than self-aggrandizing ego, which is why you do this. Now, I believe, you guys talk about Jeff Epstein?
Yeah, a lot, yes.
You've been threatened?
I mean, not directly, but
okay, I've been threatened.
I've had some weird stuff, yeah.
I've had some weird stuff. So I trust you guys in part because I know that there's no, that the risk reward on talking about Jeff Epstein is not positive, right?
Right.
Now, whatever that is, I want to reward people who are making that choice. Let me ask you another question. Is wealth important to either one of you?
I mean, yes, but not probably. It's not wealth, the end all be all.
Wealth,
right?
Wealth is important. And this is an important thing that we picked up from DC that, sorry, I think you and I will both agree on. Mm-hmm. My takeaway from being in DC in my early 20s is that you have to be independent from the system.
Yes.
So wealth is exactly important. That. I had too many experiences. And look, there's a lot of people in the comments section who will come after me for this. So you know who you are. I've had experiences where I had to work jobs or do fellowship because I needed to have a job. I needed to have like wealth and not even wealth. Just I needed to pay bills.
No, you need to pay your bills.
And I don't want to ever have to do this and think about that.
You guys are making the word yes far too complicated. Mm-hmm. There's nothing wrong with recognizing that wealth, independence, and freedom are important. And I goofed on this. It's not that I ever thought wealth wasn't important, but I thought that the wealth that really mattered most to me was the freedom to say whatever I want and know that as long as I did it responsibly and as long as I, you know, had my ducks somewhat in a row, that there would always be a Monday morning following every Friday afternoon when I chose to share my thoughts. that was a mistake on my part. And I'll just give you a piece of advice from an older guy. Care more about money and be much more unabashed about it, not because of the reasons that everybody thinks. You guys can generate your own prestige. When you guys walk down the street in Austin, I would be stunned if you weren't mobbed by young people. If you're,
it's already happened. Yeah, we got recognized a ton when we were here.
Exactly. Yeah. My point is that you don't need to generate status through wealth. That's not what you're interested. You should probably generate a certain amount of luxury through wealth, because luxury is assigned to the brain that it can afford to think more expansively. It's probably the source of importance for luxury as well as a social signal. But what my guess is that you have undervalued just how important money is to not get taken off the air. You need the ability to hire security details and lawyers. And in the immortal words of the sage Warren Zevon, send lawyers, guns, and money. What we need is we need to recognize that that is not a personal issue of wanting to become, you know, top of the pile of social climbers. It's an issue of making sure you can't get taken off the air. So what I think you guys should just say, yes, wealth is important, and not be embarrassed about it.
No, you're right. You're right.
So I think that largely speaking, what we need is we need people who are not obsessed with wealth, but who recognize that wealth is an important input into securing an ability to keep on the air.
How do you, and this is the question, and this is goes back to my, and once again, Sagar, this isn't criticism of you or Crystal.
No, go ahead.
How do you translate the baseline of staying on the air into something bigger? Because they could have kept doing Rising as they were doing in perpetuity, really great upper class lifestyle, all that junk. But it wouldn't have meant anything deeper.
But we know that they don't know. Nobody's figured this out, Marshall. I mean, this is one of
the fair. Yeah.
You know, so the point is that Sagar and Crystal failed, as Joe Rogan failed, Jordan Peterson failed, I failed, Brett failed. We are all failing, Joan. And the reason that we're all failing is not entirely clear. But whatever is going on, we don't control one institution to the point that we can make sure that it always reflects heterodoxy. The shutout of responsible heterodoxy is near perfect, even to the extent that we're not going to have somebody on who got the Wuhan lab issue right in real time, because who knows what they would bring up if they got that right. We're looking for people in our mainstream who wait until John Stewart gives the signal. It's now safe to discuss the Wuhan Institute of Virology again. And the key point is that you guys didn't wait for that. And you didn't wait on UFOs.
We took a ton of heat for it. I want people to know that.
And like, why
and
is
Crystal
it?
In particular.
Okay.
Crystal in particular just got mobbed for it. When we were discussing it, I think it was like 5 months ago. I think it was February. And I want people to know like how much pushback that we received both publicly and in general whenever it came to discussing the lab leak theory.
Yeah. So that's why, more or less, anytime you guys call, I'll always say yes. No, I'm not kidding. You know, there are very few people who get a yes. I will tell you that next time, I hope that you will put some of that sweet grift money into your backgrounds.
I only have one suit. I only have one suit in Austin, and I had to wear it on Rogan.
I've got two jackets, and I'm not wearing any pants.
don't push them on that, Sagar. So I mean, I like your dichotomy of institutions that have no access to heterodoxy, and that immediately, and we were talking about this before the recording started, podcasting and that specific environment, because that's one where at least is or very few things in the world are organic, but podcasting has been relatively, at least up until recent years, has been very organic. You can throw up an RSS feed, buy a $40 mic, it goes. But what's something that's happening in the industry is you're seeing Apple jump in, Spotify is getting big, Rogan goes to Spotify, call her daddy just recently, congrats Alex for that, goes to Spotify. I'm curious, how do you think about like the medium of podcasting when it comes to the heterodox versus corporate balance?
They figured this out. I think it was it Alex Stamos who said, you know, we have a problem that podcasting represents sort of a chink in the armor.
Yes, it was a New York Times piece, and it was like misinformation is rife on RSS feeds, nobody knows what to do about it. Right.
I'm tickled that absolutely no one is calling and saying, Eric, you know, how do we get you over to a bigger audience and get you a studio that really, I mean, absolutely zero interest. And it's not because we can't create the numbers. I mean, it's very interesting. I watched on Twitter, my number was just absolutely stalled. And it was very clear that I was being throttled. And of course, if you mention that, then it's like, oh, maybe your tweets just suck. Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
Meanwhile,
Eric, I always appreciate how self-aware you are in those interactions. You're like, that is something that someone would say.
Yeah.
No, but we are, you know, the whole thing is just the scripted part of this, the haters. Almost always, I can actually write a script to say what the bots are going to say, you know, and then the people who are bot-like, you know, we have many NPC bot-like accounts out there, some of them with millions of followers. What we have is this situation in which we all know what the game is. Everybody's in on it. We just can't break the official pretend around this. We're in the situation before Vince McMahon declared to the New Jersey Sporting Commission, you know that this is scripted, therefore you can't tax and regulate me. And at some point, the system will say, you know, we're having a fake conversation because anything else would be catastrophic to the current order as it sits. And that's where we are. Now, when it comes to fixing this, these people are going to die before too long. I'm 55, so I'm not here for the long haul. You know, 30 years from now, if I die, nobody's going to say, wow, so young. I don't even feel like I've started my career yet. Where we are is that we've been in something nobody's ever seen, which is this period from 1945 until the coronavirus, which I called the Big Nap. You know, there was the Great Leap Forward. That was the big event in some weird way. But other than that, there really wasn't a lot of early 20th century-like events. World War I, World War II, Holocausts, et cetera, you know, Spanish flu.
Right.
And so even Vesuvius didn't seem to erupt after World War II, and it did so regularly. And so when Eikjafjallajökull erupted in Iceland, our planes weren't that aware of what they were supposed to do with ash clouds. So we've been.
I'm amazed, first of all, you could even say the word, because I've always been like, how does someone pronounce that?
You know what's going to happen right now? What? We're going to have like all seven people who live in Iceland say, are you kidding? He completely tangled that role.
Yeah, well, it's ancient Danish, people, so don't expect us to actually know anything. Look, I think that the. So I have limited time. So my last real question here is about what do you make then with the open podcasting environment? What do you make of like the Rogan move to Spotify? Do you think it was better for heterodoxy and the normalization in mainstream space, or was it worse?
Well, I assume
and take Rogan out of it. Take Rogan out of it and say, in general,
it's better
people
for
go
Joe
or not?
It's better for Joe. It's worse for the rest of us. Does Joe have every right to do something which is really good for Joe and worse for the rest of us? Yeah, you know, I mean, if we don't like it, we should outbid Spotify, but we didn't. No, we didn't.
This is the billionaires not stepping up.
Issue is that we're going to have those. Joe has a reasonably open podcast. I don't know if it's as open. He's had some things taken off. You know, I have to admit that there are episodes which things happened on that show that, you know, weren't 100%. But considering the number of hours, nobody's going to fault Joe. Mm-hmm. Now, the issue is... the question is slightly invidious. It's much more important that we stick together and support Joe because of all of the things Joe continues to do than to bitch.
I support him 100%. I was more saying in a mainstream context.
No,
I always wondered.
I understand perfectly.
Yeah. Right.
But in part, you know, our integrity, I'm not neutral. I love Joe. Mm-hmm. And I'm not here to be completely objective. If you ask me to be completely objective, was it better that Joe go off of YouTube? No. Is it better that Joe have so much money that he could afford to end his deal and to continue as a beacon? Maybe in the end, Spotify turns out to be a much better deal for us because YouTube could always have thrown him off.
Yeah, true.
Right. So right. The question that you're asking, is Joe going to be subject to more control at Spotify? Yes, that's a condition of his contract. Would I take the money Joe took to go over to Spotify? Almost certainly. Will I ever be offered that kind of money, even if I put up the best numbers in human history? No effing way, because it's too dangerous to have me running around, in such a deal. You saw the way in which the employees were up in arms. So, in a weird way, Joe is up for the idea that he's trying to be interesting. And he's having interesting conversations. Wonderful. I'm not merely trying to be interesting. I pretend that I'm an entertainer, which is ridiculous. Who wants to listen to a 55-year-old father of two who's a mathematician? The issue is I'm convinced that this is not going to work. We are going to blow ourselves up. We are making more and more bad decisions that are going to accumulate, and it's going to completely poison this beautiful gift that we've been handed. So unfortunately, I'm not just about making myself happier. I can get up in the morning and have a scotch and I won't be nearly as depressed as I usually am, but that's not really, I'm not really focused on making myself happy. I think this is an emergency situation, and I've got two kids, and if I didn't have two kids, I'd still have a country to save. And I think in part that this is the unfun part about this. Yes, I want to make money. Yes, I want decent numbers. But do I want to be famous? I don't really, on balance, love it. The real reason to do this is to save the enterprise. And the enterprise at a physical, normal level, like the internet connections work, I can still buy something on Amazon. All that's still working fine. But all of the stuff that requires shared culture, that requires the ability of humans to come to consensus, that requires people not to self-deal, all of that stuff is fraying at an incredible rate. And very quickly, you're going to see more implications for the physical, logical, and financial world, where when I go under an underpass in Los Angeles, California, I see my fellow Americans living in tents with American flags. I know a lot of them are vets. I know that some of them have master's degrees because I've spoken to them. I'm looking for PhDs from the homeless community to have on the podcast. This is unacceptable. And at this level of degradation, we've never had things perfect. But this is Keystone Cops territory. And I really feel like, in part, you have to figure out whether what you want to do ultimately is to have interesting conversations and say, I can't fix the world, or whether somebody's responsible. And I think you gentlemen are afflicted with the same problem that I have, which is, I think it falls to us. I don't know why it does. I wouldn't have expected it fell to me. But if nobody else is going to bail water and we're taking on water, I'm certainly not above picking up a bucket, and I hope you guys get rich, because it's important to your continuing ability to pick up a bucket. And I hope you guys get a ton of subscribers, and I hope you guys like being famous more than I do. But we still have to save this thing. And I think it's really important, just one word of parental caution or avuncular caution. It's really important that we not go after each other. Mm-hmm. I watched some friends of mine unfollow each other. I watched, Sam Harris announce, I'm resigning from the IDW, and I'm watching other people say what caused him to say that. It's unbecoming. More tribalism is better. If you've been convinced that not hanging together with your friends and throwing people under a bus is really important to prove that you have independence, he's biased because Joe's his friend. You're damn right Joe's my friend. And, Joe just called me out for squatting on a URL. And the correct response is, hey, just call me up and I love you. Don't badmouth other people to please the braying mob that you're so objective that you would throw your friends under a bus. Challenge your friends, But much better to say, I must recuse myself because unfortunately there are people that I love that I'm loyal to, and I will not be throwing anyone under a bus to please your misguided concept of what a consistent, non-hypocritical life is meant to be.
I think that we could literally not end on a better note than that. Eric, thank you so much for joining.
Appreciate your time, Eric.
We can't wait to have you back.
The answer is always yes. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you, sir. Guys enjoyed the episode. As we said, it's been a crazy period launching Breaking Points, taking this channel to the next level, doing all these new things with the mugs. It's really exciting, but we'll be back to getting to a more normal schedule next week. Two of us in interviews again, not three interviews in one day. A lot of great stuff. So thanks for the support. We're pumped to keep talking, and we'll see you next time.